You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thanks so much for inviting me here. I'm so excited to share this project with you, but also think through a piece of the book project that I just finished, and that's the cover, a piece that didn't make it into the book that I'm hoping to work into an article. And my slides will show just how much I've been writing, because I almost have it written through the slides, so it's a little text heavy. So I apologize in advance for that. But I wanted to think through something that actually came up over the summer in a conversation at Urbana-Champaign with Christian and some folks who'd invited me to give a talk about this project. And we landed on, at the end of the discussion, why is it that policy analysts don't think about sex, sexuality, gender as central to policy work? And so in a lot of ways, this talk is my attempt to bridge the gap between policymakers who might be aware that sexuality and engagement with media have something connecting them, that a lot of people use media for thinking about their sexuality. For the young people that I worked with, it was fairly central to their negotiation of sexual identity and gender identity. But for the most part, in terms of policymaking, we tend to focus on ways to contain, particularly youth sexuality. And in many cases, we don't really talk about the dirty little secret that sex is on the internet quite a bit. So this is my attempt to get us talking about sex and talking about the internet and policy all in the same conversation. The title of my talk, which was up there, is thinking about how we can look at the relationship of young people negotiating identity and their blurring of online and offline experiences as a way to think about this broader relationship to media. I'll give you a little bit of an introduction to this broader project just so you'll know how I did this research. And I want to talk about a concept that I develop in the book called Boundary Publics that I haven't talked that much with other researchers about, but I'd love to get your feedback on, does it work? You know, what are its problems? But I want to think about it as an example of how young people work the politics of visibility in their local communities, and I'll explain what I mean by that. But I particularly want to hook it to an idea that that Paul DiMaggio and Esther Hagatare, I knew I was going to, sorry Esther, their idea about digital inequality that they introduced back in 2001, to think about how these young people are actually navigating digital inequality when they're doing this work through Boundary Publics. So that's what I want to unpack today. And hopefully this demonstrates why queer studies and sexuality and gender studies more generally could arguably be central to policy work. So that's hopefully where I'll land. The argument I want to put on the table for us all to think about today, I want to make a case that rural lesbian, gay, bi, trans questioning, and I'll just shorthand that as LGBTQ, that young rural people who are negotiating these identities rely on blurring the boundaries between online and offline performances of social visibility. So a really important point that I want to make is that I'm thinking about their identities as something collectively worked out. And to do that work, they really have to be not just visible to each other, but socially recognized. So what I want to make a case is that they're doing a kind of blurring of these performances of visibility in this use of boundary publics, and that they're combating both digital inequalities, and I have some examples of those, that are structuring their information access in their local communities, at the same time that they're also negotiating broader politics of visibility, and I'll explain what I mean by that as well, that frame them as always already out of place, that they're necessarily not supposed to be there. That popular representations, and this is actually what I'll talk about tomorrow at my book talk tomorrow on Wednesday at Microsoft, that for the most part, mainstream media and popular culture frames rural LGBT people broadly as not existing there, or certainly need to run to the big city, that there's something endemically hostile, inhospitable about rural communities. So they're already, young people are already negotiating that's what they're presenting what's presented to them. To be able to get a sense of, to be able to move past assuming that they don't live in these places, and be able to talk about, well, what is their experience like? What is it like for these young people? I wanted to give you some sense of what we know about their lives. We actually don't know that much. There's been almost no study of young people under 18 and their experiences of negotiating non-normative sexualities and genders in the rural United States, let alone outside the United States. So this is, in ethnographic terms, in macro-level terms, we know almost nothing because we've never asked these young people what their lives are like in any capacity. So that's probably one of the most important things. But literature and popular culture frame their sexualities and genders as individual mental health issues. And that's for the most part how we think about dealing with this population, whether they're in urban centers or elsewhere. We imagine these are young people who are individually struggling with a coming out process. And that's really the narrative of their young lives, that they're moving through that process, but they're doing it individually through struggle, and there are different conditions that set the dynamics of that struggle. Rural environments are almost without exception, again, think popular representations here, Brokeback Mountain, or any representation of what LGBT life is supposed to look like. For the most part, it defaults to an urban model. The presumption is that LGBT communities are urban phenomenon, that they don't exist. And if they do exist in rural places, that it's a diminished experience of existence. So if you're rural LGBT identifying young, that you get out as quickly as possible. That's the assumption. So this is a lot of what I was confronted with when I started this work. And I started this work in 1998, and then 2001 through 2004 did ethnographic field work in rural Kentucky and its border states, what we commonly refer to as Appalachia. But I'm fairly resistant to just cordoning it off as Appalachia. I'm actually very interested in how much these young people were circulating through their regions. So it's not that they're really contained in those particular areas. They spill out. But that's where I was doing most of my work. And I worked directly with 34 young people who were the primary informants for this project, participants for this project, but talked with well over 100 other young people and adult advocates who were in their communities. And through those analyses came back to what kinds of web content, particularly web-based materials, were important to them. So I really worked from rather finding young people who were already online and thought it's really helpful. I wanted to work with young people who were in particular circumstances where their access may or may not be contained or diminished, may or may not have direct access themselves in their homes. So I wanted to figure out what are their conditions for access, and therefore what kind of difference does it make in their everyday life. I'm particularly interested in everyday uses of digital media. And I was kitchen sink approach. Any sort of theoretical framework that was going to help me do this work, that's where I ran. And luckily I was trained at UC San Diego, which has a fairly interdisciplinary approach to media studies. So from science technology studies to media studies to post-colonial studies, who have a lot to say about development and the language of outreach, and who has limited resources and how you address those populations. You name it, there were literatures to kind of sew together to be able to approach this project. One of the most important premises that I want to put on the table, in addition to the argument that I want to make, that'll be most of what I talk about tomorrow, is that what I found in looking at these young people's lives and the narratives that they were constantly pushing against, I realized at the end of the day, there are effectively three assumptions that are organizing the expectations of how visible they're supposed to be. Three assumptions that we make in LGBT political work, that organize the legislative action that we do, that really, for the most part, are the unexamined assumptions of what is queer life like, and what organizes it. The first one is that LGBT people have access to a critical mass of folks, that I can go to a part of Boston, all I need to do is, you know, maybe have a Grindr handy, I'm going to find out where there's a critical mass of at the very least, lesbian or gay identifying people. And that we're looking at, you know, being able to walk into a room of 40 people. The second assumption is that we have access to capital, that if even if I don't have the money, I can find a donor base that's going to be able to pony up and help me organize legislative action. So if I'm in San Francisco, which I'm originally from California, if I'm in San Francisco, I know there's a neighborhood I can hit and I'm going to be able to raise money to do the political work that I need to do. So whether I'm personally representing myself or organizing with others, that I'm going to have that capital to do that work. And then lastly, that I have access to safe spaces, and these are all interlocked, but that I literally can walk to the Castro or to Christopher Street, that I can go to places in Miami, that I literally can name physical spaces and places where I can go, that I can connect to lesbian, gay, less so bi and trans identifying people. And importantly, I can come and go from those spaces. I can work out my identity through a kind of low-risk anonymity, in that when I move into those spaces, I may or may not run into my boss, but my odds are, if I run into my boss, we probably just learn we have something in common. It's not that I'm necessarily trekking across the rest of my life space, so I'm not likely to run into my family, not likely to run into my friends who I'm not out to. So in terms of organizing the politics of visibility, the expectations of what it means to be an LGBT person and advocate of LGBT politics, these three assumptions really structure the kind of visibility that's expected. That I'm going to find a lot of folks, can amass our capital fairly easily, and then I can move in and out of spaces that we control. None of these forms of what I'll call social information, because in a lot of ways these three linchpins are effectively the raw materials for the narratives about LGBT life, like what it's supposed to look like, whether I'm supposed to go to a bar or a softball field to find a date, like those kinds of things are worked out through these structures. And none of these structures exist in rural places. I put in parenthetically just, because I think we can think about a kind of conservatism that defines the rural United States. But it's not just that conservatism, that ethos of conservatism, that's preventing these bits of social information from taking hold in rural communities. It's literally infrastructurally absent from rural communities. So by raw numbers, most of the young people I was working with on a good day could expect to amass, through working several counties together, 10 of their friends, 15 of their friends. Like they're such dispersed numbers. There isn't the kind of consolidation that you can find in an urban center. There is no capital. In the places that I was working in particularly South Central Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky, in that border of Tennessee and Kentucky, we're looking at unemployment rates in the 40 percentile. So it's incredibly impoverished. So the ability to even pay for a membership, an annual or a monthly membership for an LGBT political organization, was out of the reach of most of the people I met, let alone for the young people that I met. And then lastly, in terms of safe spaces, and I think this is the most important for the discussion today, is that there are no places imagined in these rural communities where you can occupy public space, be socially visible, recognized, and get in and get out. You are constantly working not with anonymity, but with familiarity. Everybody assumes they know you, and you assume everybody knows you in turn, and that they've known you all your lives. So young people really have to deal with an entirely different set of circumstances when they're working out their identities. They have to rely on allies, almost to exclusion. The advocates who are in their daily life are adult allies who are straight identifying. They also have to rely on their legibility as locals. So not in any sentimental way, family and familiarity is the most important social identity and currency for these young people. Holding on to that kind of familiarity is what literally guarantees you have a place to sleep, you have access to food, housing, and jobs. Most of the networking, whether we want to call it nepotism or not, most of the networking and resources are organized through the family, because there's such an impoverished social infrastructure. There isn't a public structure to support these young people. So they're heavily reliant on that legibility as locals, which means they're constantly navigating being seen as so-and-so's son or daughter or longtime friend, and marking themselves as queer, which is not just different, but urban. So it plays out the kind of inside outsider politics that organize rural life. They take a strategy of pooling resources, and at the same time we're talking about very, very limited resources. So it's a different process, I would argue, than the kind of amassing of capital that can happen in urban centers where you might be able to go to a stranger or to do a donor drive in a neighborhood you've never been in. So to make it even more concrete, imagine trying to go to a neighborhood in a rural community and raise money for a same-sex marriage petition, where you're literally going to the houses of folks you've known all your life who may or may not know why that politics is particularly interesting to you. The ability to draw resources together from that limited pool are so so constrained that for the most part, they can't use money to mobilize. And then lastly, and this will lead me into the thick of what I'd like to argue today, is that they, instead of being able to take advantage of anonymity and safe spaces where they can come and go, they actually build their own boundary publics. They take spaces and will occupy them. And one of the examples I'll talk about tomorrow is Drag at Walmart, which is probably one of my favorite examples of young people who would basically go to the Walmart and do drag in the middle of the night. So they'll temporarily occupy these spaces, make them their own, but with an acknowledgement that it's going to be a fairly temporary occupation, that they're going to only have so much time and so much social room given to taking up these spaces. And that's necessarily where digital media come into play. That their use of digital media as a way of expanding their sense of publicness and visibility proves to be fairly central for most of these young people. So the drag at Walmart, again, that I'll talk about tomorrow, really becomes a social collective event of making oneself visible when the photos of the drag at Walmart are posted to the website. So how much involving digital media as a way of representing the action that's taken place becomes central to their logic of constructing identity. I thought I better give a little bit more definition. It's in the book, but by what I mean by boundary publics and queer identity work, because I know there's probably a range of expertise in the room in terms of approaches to thinking about how sexuality and identity work. I'm working from the assumption that identity here, queer identity, is crafted collectively. It's not something innate that's expressed, but in terms of articulation of identity, not desire, but identity, that coming up with the grammar and organizing the language for how I represent who I am is a highly, thoroughly social process. So where do these young people get the raw materials for that cobbling together of the language and articulation of identity? And that's what I'm interested in, how situated, how place-based that is, that rural young people would have a fundamentally different process. And theoretically, that means the experience of identity negotiation would be different in any location. Hopefully, that's another contribution of this work. But in terms of boundary publics, what I'm doing here is riffing off public sphere theory. So Habermas and the notion of the public sphere and critiques of the public sphere, from Michael Warner and Nancy Fraser's about counterpublics, and really feeling like counterpublics doesn't quite do the trick. So this is why I decided I want something else. And the goal was really to be able to think about something. Counterpublics suggest something that's a counterpoint that's fixed and longstanding. And I think Warner in particular gives room for saying it's a bit less solid than that. But I wanted something that would describe what I was seeing, which was a kind of iterative in the sense of we're going to keep going back to the same location, occupy it, and leave. Ephemeral, that this experience of creating a queer space and moment of visibility in Walmart is going to evaporate when the conditions no longer allow us to do this work. And that it happens both at the centers and outskirts of these towns. So it's not just that they're going to Walmart, they're also going to public parks that are in faraway places, that it's literally drawing together all these spaces. And increasingly for the youth that I was working with, and this is pre-launch of Facebook and MySpace, so what I'm really jonesing to do is get back in the field and see how that's shifted for them. I'll talk a teeny bit about that today. But what they were doing was also drawing on predominantly narratives, coming out stories that they were finding on websites, personal websites, as well as commercial websites that were portals for LGBT communities. And they were drafting, drawing on those narratives and also their own production of those moments, like Walmart, and the example that I want to show you in a moment of their own personal websites, to document their presence, to document their visibility, to make it concrete. And I believe that these boundary publics also signal their responses to digital inequality. And that's the piece where I really feel DiMaggio and Esther give us some, give me some really great material to think through. House is also about the broader infrastructural conditions of information access. Sorry, I'm going so quickly, so feel free to stop me at any time. But here's their definition of digital inequality, and I hope it's familiar to you all. I mean, I felt like it was such a shift from thinking about digital divide as on-off, have-not, to a way of looking at what is the quality of access. What are the questions that we should be asking when we're really trying to determine whether somebody has effective access to digital technologies and to information media? And they offer five dimensions of digital inequality that are incredibly helpful for me in thinking through what exactly young people were doing in these towns. So in terms of what kind of equipment access do people have, that's usually where we stop. But what kind of autonomy of use do folks have? What kind of skill level do they have and support to develop those skills? And then lastly, how is technology situated as its purpose locally? Like, how is it presented? Is it presented as something that's strictly educational, something that's strictly for economic gain or drive? And I feel policymakers have a lot, could do a lot of great work here by making the case that a kind of sexual reproductive freedom for these young people would also be a valuable purpose. That's very idealistic of me. I'm seeing heads nod. But imagine if we acknowledged how central media and media engagements were to young people's negotiation of sexuality and gender, and that we not only recognized that, shifted from a kind of containment strategy to let's underwrite a kind of healthy exploration. So I'm that's where I'm going, which I do recognize is a tough one. Here are some examples of what I would say set up the digital inequality that are impeding rural LGBT youth's information access. One of the key issues that came up for me was realizing how many of the young people I was working with didn't have access to broadband, dial-up was spotty. In most cases, they did not have a PC in their home, so there was no access point at home. If there was a home computer, it was a shared computer. There was no privacy. In terms of autonomy of use, this is where I'm just dying to go back in the field, and if anybody has great data on this, would love to hear it. Most, particularly in Kentucky, let me use the case of Kentucky, most of the schools were actually wired. They had broadband access at their schools, in the public schools. All of those computers were heavily filtered, were monitored so that every keystroke was counted. And the conditions for the state to get the funding to wire those schools and to equip them with computers came with the requirement of that filtering. Policymakers, in terms of interventions, can't think of a more important intervention we could make. Rather than creating more content, for example, for young people around sexual freedom, sexual health, creating more content, we have to be looking at issues of access on the other end. Yes.
That's federal and state.
Federal and state, and actually, the federal was the grants that the schools that the state was able to get that managed to wire all of the counties and almost all the public schools, and at this point, all the public schools in Kentucky specifically had this federal mandate in terms of having monitoring software, and the state just complied. There was no pushback, and I don't know how many of us are really looking at the on-the-ground experiences of public schools, because it is such a difficult picture to gather. Every district really has autonomy in making these kinds of decisions, unless it's something that's mandated by the state or by the federal government.
And it really depends very much on whether or not you got grant money.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So when you're dealing with public schools that didn't take grant money for their computer usage.
Yep.
Then they have local decision making only.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the poorer you get, the more likely you're going to get the combination of federal and state and local.
Yeah. So there's no
You're more strangled in those situations.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no negotiation. I mean, the other, you know, that's, it almost feels too obvious. I feel like we've stopped paying attention to literacy skills, not media literacy skills, but basic literacy skills that might be inhibiting for young people, particularly on dial-up, who are not really going to be able to do something that's going to jump over texting or text-based communication. So for a number of these young people, their literacy skills were a barrier to their use. And then in terms of social support, and the example I wanted to give here, it was so limited and so varied. And one of for anybody who's from a small town, power brokers in those towns who often have held the few fairly stable, well-paying positions in those towns become key players in what Doreen Massey, one of my favorite geographers, talks about as power proximities. So the local librarian as a key figure in whether or not young people are going to have access to an unmonitored, still filtered in most cases. For example, almost all social media is filtered from the public libraries in Kentucky. But in terms of a key player in these young people's access, it was the librarian, the county librarian. It gave me this whole new love of librarians. I mean, they were critical. So one example I had from fieldwork was the decision of a librarian in one county to literally reposition the monitors so that there wasn't an easy way for anybody to see what was on someone's screen when they were surfing online. That was cited for a number of the young people I worked with as a pivotal moment when they felt a kind of access that they'd never felt before. It wasn't about the presence of the computer. It was about its position and this one person's ability to reposition it to make all the difference. And then, you know, lastly, the point about technology's purpose, there's nothing in what's presented as the purpose of technology in the everyday lives of these young people that says it's okay for them to do what they're doing. And that becomes incredibly unhealthy for most of those young people in terms of how far they have to drive to get access to that information, how far they have to drive for even safer sex materials or information. Most of them are at least a good 2 hours away from basic information because it's not provided by their public health officials, and not because it's a maniacal evil plot in rural communities as much as there's no funding to get those materials into communities. So one of the ways to sidestep any sort of broader arguments about resources is to not bring anything contestable into those public spaces. So this is the backdrop of setting up why I think boundary publics become so important to young people and why this blurring of offline and online life becomes so critical. And so I thought I'd show you some sample boundary publics. One, this is a public a picnic shelter, just to make the case that we're really not easily going to be able to tease out offline from online. This is a photo that was taken after a Pride picnic event that was posted to a website. So really trying to push us thinking about what exactly is this space, this picnic event, before it's posted to this website as kind of planting a flag, literally and figuratively. Another one of my favorites was this Methodist church that had set up a skate park where young people were able to go dancing, and there was a fairly thriving queercore scene, which is a kind of punk music. And it was a fantastic alternative venue because who doesn't feel like their cover is safe by having their parents drop them off at church? So all these young people could basically gather at this church, which is a skate park, by night, and they effectively had the kind of anonymous space that otherwise is not available to them, at least somewhat protected from their parents and their peers. And the young people who produced a lot of the music also recorded their music and streamed it online, so they would make their music available. And the only way you know about most of these groups was word of mouth. So Jarvis Avenue, shout out to Jarvis Avenue, really great punk group that's in central Kentucky, would perform here and also post their music and make it available to folks who had signed up on their list at this concert. Sorry for the bad web design. This was the early 2000s. This is the website of the last example of a boundary public that I want to talk about, which is produced by AJ. AJ is female to male, so he was born female. and identifies now as male. He transitioned and was in the middle of transitioning his gender identity when I met him. And he kept a very detailed website of his transition. And I want to make a case for why this website, this personal website, is an important boundary public. What he called his FTM journey, this website, and I know it's hard to see it, so I thought I'd point out the features of it. It had constant updates and an About Me section. It had a gallery of testosterone effects where he would take photographs of his body as it was changing and post them to the website. And I should note, this is an old tripod site. So this is back when it would have been very hard to find this particular website. You would have to know to go to this website. It wasn't indexed. If you can think back to those days when there was no Google, so to find AJ, to know where this website was, would have been quite a bit of work. So who is his audience? Who is he trying to be visible to what I want you to be thinking here. He kept a complete log of his surgery post and post-op and pre-op surgeries, also a list of doctors and prices for everything he had done and where he had to go to get that work done. He kept a links page not just to trans resources, but also to other trans youth who kept the same sort of journal, which really has become a genre for trans youth in terms of posting these kinds of details. He had a great guest book that was completely filled with his cousins and immediate family, and the first entry is his mom, who basically says, "Great job." And she's regularly posting this guest book. So most of this guest book is filled with those kinds of affirmations that he may not necessarily hear on a day-to-day basis, but that he can read. And then lastly, I thought I'd share, really to blur what's on and offline for me, a voice clip that he would update part of the gallery of T effects, of testosterone effects, was the effect of testosterone on his voice. So
today is September 5th, 2003. And I've been on testosterone for 13 months.
So every month he would post a new voice clip. And what I would argue is that, before I go to conclusions, let me go back to that site. What I'd argue is that all of these components both establish his visibility locally, make his queerness a local phenomenon, and also create a sense of belonging that in many ways counter the absence of a visible trans community that certainly if he went to an urban center he could see. But because he and the majority of the young people I was working with did not have the economic or social means to move, he was reliant on using this experience of a boundary public to create his sense of authenticity as a trans person. So this boundary public serves a very important role in suturing his sense of who can I be in this community and how can I bring something that's otherwise seen as so outside of this community to this space. It negotiates this need for a kind of publicness within a sort of distanced, quasi-anonymous environment that allows him to work out some of these details. So when I met him, he was trans-identifying, but he was moving towards identifying solely as a man rather than a trans man. So him working out those details, this becomes a space where he can work out those details without necessarily having the surveillance of his family or his friends who may not even be able to understand the distinction between those two terms. Let me pull it together, hopefully, by making the case that for what I was seeing, it seemed that new media was not a matter of escape, but about creating local belonging. And I think certainly in the early 2000s, when advocates around LGBT political organizing thought about what can we do with these resources, we can create ways for folks to be able to come together where they're not restricted by their local circumstances, and particularly for outreach to be able to see this as a way to help young people without necessarily changing their local conditions. Most of these young people demonstrated they were much more interested in figuring out how to be queer at home. Granted, in terms of the sample, these are all folks who don't have the choice but to make do with where they're at. So in many ways, it's a social theory of making do. These are not young people who will ever have the option of moving to a city. these boundary publics, I think, map the particular entanglements of digital media and digital inequality, but also the broader politics of visibility, that there really isn't a way to understand why these boundary publics are so important without also understanding what's at stake in being visible. Why is visibility, and I mean literally like a coming out process, seen as so central to an authentic LGBT identity? Why that today is the most important move you can make, is that kind of coming out process. And if that's compromised, or there are different conditions for that in rural communities because of the expectations around remaining local, being legible as a local, then what do young people do with that tension? So what they're working against isn't just the struggle of coming out, it's the struggle of dealing with a lack of access to information, meeting at the crossroads of this intense expectation of a kind of visibility that they can't perform because of their local circumstances and their workarounds, their efforts to deal with that, to be able to bridge that. My hope is that this makes a case for why policy analysts and policymakers should care, or at the very least see this as a site of investigation. And maybe they care about it, and maybe it's being investigated more than I realize. So I'd love to hear from you all if perhaps I'm wrong, and there's work out there that is looking at these young people as resources that'll help us learn about this confluence of media engagement and the broader politics that make that engagement possible. So that's what I have for you. And I know I threw a lot of stuff at you, but I would just really love to hear your thoughts and comments about where we're at.
I just have two quick questions. One is, what percentage of the general population is LGBT? That was a question, Adam. That's here as well. I mean, that has policy implications if it's 1 in 12.
Absolutely.
Is something like that. That's a serious number.
This is the tough thing, is that when we come up with those calculations, often 10%, anywhere from 2% or 10% is given as this is a baseline for the percentage of population who might be lesbian or gay identifying. We actually have almost no research on bi identification, trans identification in terms of population. But here's the thing, that number is hitched to Alfred Kinsey's early work in terms of percentages of folks who have same-sex attractions and have had same-sex experiences. It doesn't really work from an angle that thinks about identity as something constructed. So how many, I mean, the possibilities are endless in terms of the number of people who might ultimately come to these identities. But that estimation, if I'm just going to go with a different way of looking at it, it's about biology, the estimate's about 10%. And so if you're looking at a rural community, I would tend to critically push against assuming that we'd ever be able to get the raw numbers. It would be, can we make a case for expanding young people's vocabulary for their sexuality and gender? And that's huge. I know that's, you know, pushing against the grain here, but that's the toughest part of it.
The other question is, drag at Walmart. What is that?
Yeah. So I'm so glad you asked.
Is it in the Walmart?
It's in the Walmart. So okay. One of my favorite, and I left it out because I'm going to talk about it tomorrow, and I didn't want to give you too much overlap if you come tomorrow. But so there were these young people who were so surprised that I was surprised, but I was talking to them about, well, where you hang out, what do you do? And they said, well, you know, we hang out at, you know, they'd name a random fast food place in the parking lot. And, oh, we go to Walmart probably about a couple times a month, and we do drag in Walmart. And that's what we do for fun. So it was, and we take pictures of ourselves and we post them online. And I was just amazed. And of course, for the main reason they gave for why Walmart, doing drag, so they actually would go to Walmart, and one of the reasons they said why Walmart, all the drag attire is right there. So they would put on the fuzzy jackets, they had all the makeup to try on, so they were predominantly gay identifying white young men would go to this regional supercenter 24-hour Walmart, and the reasons they cited in terms of why make this a boundary public, the materials are already there for great drag, for a kind of trashy drag that was very hip and popular for them. It's open 24 hours, and there's no other place that is where they live. These are overwhelmingly dry counties, so there aren't bars. There are no social spaces that are the familiar social spaces of urban centers. And they had friends who worked there. So their sense of how do I negotiate this space, as long as my friend is working and on a shift, I'm good.
Sense of what role Walmart plays in life of the straight kids there?
That's a really great question. They would have, I mean, most of them were doing this drag while their friends were shopping in other aisles, or their acquaintances were shopping in other aisles. And the other contingency, so I think it's all about kind of reading the contingencies of what makes these spaces ephemeral and somewhat fragile, is that they also almost always were doing this when they knew there weren't going to be, their antagonists weren't going to be in this space. So they had a very good sense of who was going to harass them. Because as they said, we've been harassed by those folks all our lives. There was nothing novel. There was no stranger danger. Their sense of who was going to hurt them was intimately familiar. So in most cases, they would plan it around particular football games that were happening, so they knew other folks were going to be at the football game. But their straight friends were, this is also a very popular place to go for all of the local teens, because there really isn't anything else in the area. For these young people. So it was a fairly central scene for straight kids, too.
Question from the ceiling.
Oh, sure.
This is from Moment in the Ceiling. He says, I have a preconception that rural conservative places would try to suppress both queer expression and identity, but I'd like to know if this is accurate. What, if any, kind of pushback or resistance do queer rural youth face, either explicit or implicit? You mentioned the librarian who made an enormously important decision to turn the computer monitors. How common is it for them to find allies or even people who are aware of queer issues?
Right. I mean, I think one of the most important, hopefully one of the most important messages that folks can take away from this project is that we vastly overestimated the hostility, the endemic hostility of rural places. I would argue it's certainly violent. It's differently violent than the kind of violence that young people face in urban centers. I think we've overestimated the kind of violence that structures rural experience of difference. The issue here is that young people recognize that difference can be incredibly risky. And so what they do with that is they're constantly reworking this line of familiarity. They're always reminding people that they're, hey, you've known me all my life, whether explicitly or implicitly. And they often find allies through parents and friends who say, you know, that's just Dale. He's always been like that. So being able to rely on a kind of consistency of difference is often something that these young people are turning to. The kids who had the hardest time, and something I talk about in the book, are the kids who are coming from outside the community, and that might mean they've not been there their entire lives because these are places that don't have a lot of mobility. There's also a lot of class stratification. Middle class kids were, on the whole, more protected because their parents were the power brokers in town than working class, working poor kids. Working class, working poor kids had the brunt of violence directed at them, and it was, I think, redirected from any of the other kinds of social stratification that's happening in these high schools, particularly in the high schools. All of them uniformly said it sucked. I think most young people would say high school is a very hostile place. Anybody working with this demographic knows that's fairly consistent. So the story here is it's really not across the board awful. Different kinds of conditions make different kinds of communities more livable than others. But on the surface, if you're an outsider looking in, it looks inhospitable because we don't see the kinds of things that resonate as safe spaces or resonate as a kind of visibility that we see as markers of a kind of acceptance. So it's dicey in terms of where that acceptance, where it comes from, and what it looks like, which for me means we need to do more of this work. But obviously, I'm biased. There's a hand down there.
Say anything about how this compares to the experience of sexual identity creation in urban areas, especially with kids who are also experiencing issues of digital divide and conservatism.
Yep.
So minority communities or low-income communities in cities.
I feel like there is so. One of the first projects I did was for young people, queer identifying political organizers in cities in San Francisco. And that was a fairly diverse group of kids. And it was specifically around sexuality and gender. And in many ways, I came to this project because there were a number of young people who had left small towns and were playing out that narrative of, it's horrible where I came from, I want to be in a city. But what struck me in thinking about that project and this one was the similarities in terms of marginalization, what are key resources, public resources that become pivotal, the library. I mean, I think that there's actually hopefully a lot that, particularly from post-colonial theory, that plays out in rural communities that's the same, you know, looking at what happens to marginalized communities more broadly in the discussion of the digital divide, that map onto to urban young people's experiences. So this, and actually, and let me put it in specific terms, in terms of sexuality and gender identity, that for queer identifier, queer kids of color, the importance of juggling multiple social identities and really having to prioritize the social identity that gives you the most stability, that's exactly what these rural white kids are doing. And they were because the area I'm working is overwhelmingly white, like 96% white. In some places, 98% white. Some of these towns are sundown towns, so they have a very racist, brutal history of why it's so white. But the few kids of color who were in this project, who participated in this project, without exception, their priority was their community of color. Like, that was the place where, in terms of keeping their social identity front and center, that was the identity that took priority, because their families depended so much on a kind of solidarity. So that sort of negotiation, what this taught me was the expectation of and the kind of moralizing that comes with assuming that coming out as lesbian, gay, bi, trans should be one's personal priority over any other identity has a lot of racist assumptions built into it. And I'm not the first to say it. Marlon Ross, who's a wonderful literary scholar, has made a similar argument about what he calls claustrophilia, the love of the closet, like that we have such an interest in a kind of visibility that prioritizes those very specific identity categories without recognizing for many people that's going to compromise some other social identity. And we haven't really addressed that. So thanks for asking that question. Yeah.
Is there any kind of online boundary public? I mean, any kind of community, online community or website, not only those kind of individual blogger, but also those guys, those little youth people can connect each other, rural youth people can connect each other, I mean online. If there is no internet, they may never know each other.
Right.
This kind of online public boundary.
That's really interesting, because I think the way I've structured this rubric, this notion of boundary publics, is that it necessarily resists any distinction between the two. And I was taking a fairly polemic, like, I want to make a case that there really aren't effective divisions to make here any longer, that the discussion about offline, online has really lost its saliency, or it's lost its purpose. But I mean, you're bringing up a really interesting question. How would I theorize, and I'm trying to think of concrete examples that I came across, how would I theorize particular social networks? And that might be what might change this theory for me is going back in and seeing what do they do with MySpace communities or different communities that perhaps give a bit more structure than the kind of linking of personal websites did back, you know, when I was initially doing this work.
And my guess from it would be, like from my field work when I was doing the social network sites, the move between the kids who maintained live journals identities and those who were in the more popular social network sites that were mainstream to their schools, that movement is a very interesting one. So they were active on both of these sites, the thing that was, you know, quote unquote normative, and the live journal where it was much more subculturally identified.
Mm-hmm.
And that, this is this interesting takeover, because there are things that would be seamless, jokes that would happen in at the time MySpace, which were referencing back to live journal identities being built, and likewise critiques of what was happening on MySpace, which was the normative school space, that were taking place within the queer identified communities on live journal. And so I think that as these spaces become, you know, you have these sort of different kinds of controls of how everybody is there, you'll see some of that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And that movement be really present, which would be fascinating for you to see how it's playing out now.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking of, for the case for the youth that I was working with, even their access to MySpace, and just kind of going back in the field casually in the last couple summers, they have such limited access to social media. So I'm trying to imagine if their access is so compromised, whether they could build that kind of boundary public that's kind of bridging different social media sites? So it is a really fascinating question.
This is, I guess, sort of a follow-on, and maybe exactly the same question. So in addition to wondering if there are online boundary publics, and granting that you want to push the end of the distinction between offline and online, I guess I want to ask about the distinction anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What is there, if anything, about the addition of the online that adds to the formation of identity or the nature of the groups or anything? What does the online bring, even if they're not entirely distinct?
Right. I think the two things that I feel that it brings for them is both this planting of a flag, like literally having this sense of a marker that creates I want to argue a kind of materiality to their presence. So something that even if it's, you know, websites that, you know, they disappear, they reappear, but for that moment, for the time in which these young people are engaging these sites, it becomes this concrete way to have the equivalent of a standing building that's specifically for them, that it creates that sense of permanent structure that's never going to be possible in their environments. I think it does that. And then the second thing is that I think for a number of them, it allows them to literally participate in the narrative about what counts as an authentic LGBT person. So they are bombarded. They're literally bombarded with representations of LGBT life that pretty much exclude them. Or if it includes them, it looks awful. I mean, there are very few representations of LGBT life in a rural context that don't end in tragedy, and it's vile and ugly. And so that's kind of what they're working with. And I think this the use of the online becomes a way of producing a narrative that breaks that down. Like, here's what it's, life's not so bad here. Like, literally, it becomes their opportunity to participate in producing that narrative that otherwise they have absolutely, I mean, literally have no hand in, because most of those productions are coming out of urban centers. So I think it's doing both those things, both giving this sense of local belonging that's structured and permanent, even though it's not, and creating the sense of I get to participate in the narrative of what my life is like without having it be dictated to me by the mainstream. Yeah.
This follows up on that a little bit as well. I mean, so about 10 years ago, Ernie Wilson was writing that if you think about online versus offline, you need to think about production, because every time we think about digital divide,
absolutely, yeah,
we're making assumptions about, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean if you're online, you can consume or that you can produce? Because production implies different skills, it implies different equipment, it implies different costs, yeah, and so on. So, I mean, your talk mostly focused on these tropes of exploration and education, but then you have these instances of production, like the website with the sound clips on it, right? Yeah. So the person making the website with the sound clips probably isn't making it at the public library, right? I mean, you need special equipment for that and a special space. So I just wonder, could you say a little more about the production? Like, do you think, yeah, that, I mean, how common was the production in the studies that you did? And is everyone in the rural communities looking at a few highly visible sort of reference sites or, mm-hmm, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So is there someone writing the narrative of, you know, the rural queerness that everyone is referring, mm-hmm, to? Or is everybody, you know, collaborating in this very decentralized way that's more like a, you know, a live journal of my friend or something like that?
It was much, at the time when I was originally doing this work, I think it was harder to create your own website, or that was a little bit more clunky. So user-generated content that was strictly, you know, posting something to a GeoCities website or something fairly rudimentary was what many of the youth would do if they were producing anything. But in more cases than not, there were one or two leaders in the community who were creating the website where you're sending them a photo, you're sending literally a photo, you know, and you're going to scan it, not a digital photo, because digital cameras weren't that common either. At this point, that's shifted. Enough of them have camera phones, so that's what's happened for a number of them. But a lot of the production was collaborative and centralized. So it was collaborative. Like, we're gonna move all of our pictures and we're gonna send them to Dale, and he's gonna get them up on the website because I have no idea how to do it. And then we're gonna share in this website. And a lot of looking at what was produced was within this small circle of folks because it wasn't so easily locatable. So AJ is somewhat of the exception in terms of his use of the microphone that was on his computer to be able to create those voice clips. His design skills, no offense to AJ, if you're listening, not so high end. But I think in terms of the interest, what's driving the production, with perhaps the exception of the Queer Core kids, what they were interested in doing with the production end of it was about a kind of collaborative process, less of a me media and more of an us media experience of production.
Your question
at the time
also has a really interesting political slant to it, which is that for the longest time, the obsession around filtering was an obsession about a certain kind of consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the obsession with porn really came into framing what kinds of access were viable. What has happened in the last 5-6 years is actually the shift has been about controlling certain kinds of production, usually around the predator conversation, which is
right.
That if you could produce content, you would put up things that would make you at risk. And so a lot of what has been banned in the schools and all of these other spaces has been so heavily about a certain kind of production, which even though, you know, arguably putting up a video is not an issue, is the idea of putting it up into certain kinds of UGC spaces
right.
that were fundamentally fraught because
right.
they allowed for interaction and gasp, we don't want interaction.
Right.
And I think that that's going to get worse with the sexting thing.
Yeah.
But so I see the, you know, and the one big shift, like, I saw from rural
mm-hmm.
environments is that unlike urban kids from working poor or working class backgrounds, the rural kids have no model of proxies.
Yeah.
So all
That's
of
true.
My urban kids knew proxies. It was like straight up, and they worked around the restrictions. But the rural kids, non-existent. So, which you lack these overrides.
Yeah.
That were so critical to this in terms of the filtering.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, going back to this conversation again, you mentioned this thing about AJ's aesthetics
mm-hmm.
and his design skills, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but you could say that the reason the website looked like that doesn't have anything to do with his aesthetics. It's that, you know, the idea of web production hadn't really stabilized to a genre. And so
yeah.
that was particularly okay way to make web pages. Whereas now with what,
yeah.
you know, Dana's talking about,
yeah.
like the web 2.0 social networks, you might get easier production, but it's very regimented. You
yeah.
know, it's even in the comparatively more accessible and customizable systems, you're choosing from a series of choices that are sort of laid out for you in a way that the web pages weren't. And so that has big implications if you're part of a, say, a minority population that might have different sensibility about what information you want to make visible.
Right.
Right. So, and I guess this is more of a comment for a future study about, you know, web 2.0 or Facebook. And
I think that what you're reminding me is thinking about the kind of stabilizing of genres that happened for the youth that I was looking at and the content I was looking at in terms of what were expectations, what were shaping out to be the expectations of their own kind of politics and visibility of what needs to be on this site and where the priorities were. So, I mean, I think you're right in terms of what kinds of aesthetic values had shaken out and been built into what are we supposed to do with this media. This is really before that moment. It was, I think you're right, probably more, it was looser in terms of what you could do with that wasn't the expectation in terms of production. It was, do you have the gallery? You know, do you have the guest book? Do you have these, you know, these key pieces that are part of that performance of self? So there's something, I want to think about your question because I feel like there's something else that it brought up for me, but we can chat anytime.
I have a question about, just in terms of what you presented here, mostly
mm-hmm.
focused on the ways in which certain kinds of internet spaces are part of these boundary publics
mm-hmm.
and part of something that's more local. And so I guess I'd like to hear you talk more about how you connect what you learned in this project with the long history of queer folks from out of the way places
mm-hmm.
Communicating with each other through the post
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and newsletters and, you know, so sort of going back through older kinds of media
mm-hmm.
Networks
mm-hmm.
that produce the possibilities for the formation of different kinds of queer identities. And here I'm thinking of, you know, the territory of my own field work in India, where
mm-hmm.
these correspondence
yeah.
relationships are still very active. So I just, if you could say something about that history and where you place this and that.
That's such a great, I'll give you a book, because one of my favorite books on this is Martin Meeker. He's a historian, Martin Meeker's Contacts Desired, and he looked at the history of the creation of different guides, particularly men's guides to finding each other in town, so what are kind of places to have public sex, Damon's guides, and he has a little bit on early, what were called homophile movements, their early correspondence. And to be honest, even though we know there's a long history of that kind of correspondence across spaces that would be a fantastic model for this, we don't have a lot historically on what does that look like for folks outside of urban centers. We don't have a lot of archives of the conversations, the exchange, the correspondence of folks who were sending letters in the U.S., sending letters outside of major metropolitan areas, because most of what we have are archives that are filled by folks who live primarily in cities, who then deposit their materials in archives, and that's the record we have. So
you don't have people from the so-called hinterlands writing to the Madison Society saying?
Very few, and actually, if anything,
we're wondering.
If any, the best thing is that the archives of those associations are at Indiana University, where I'm at. So I haven't had a chance to dive into them, but no one's really looked at the relationship between the correspondence that's coming from those places of folks writing in like, oh, I've never known anybody like me. Nobody's really looked at that. So, I mean, it would be a fantastic bridge to this project, which would be an earlier form of that sort of mediated communication, for sure.
Am I off base in thinking that maybe the zine culture of the early 90s would be a dot to connect between pen pals and a live journal communities?
Absolutely.
Because I got the sense that was a very active way of expressing voices from disconnected points geographically and in terms of community and creating broad community that was stamp-based.
No, absolutely. And I think that we were talking about earlier work on zines, thinking about how it's about a kind of circulation that's happening between large and mid-sized cities, but not necessarily hinterland to hinterland.
Okay.
So but certainly zines have been created by folks who are in the hinterland, so it's not to say that's not happening, but in terms of the circulation, it's often about swapping a different urban culture for another, like, you know, San Francisco and going to New York, going to Chicago versus, Urbana to Somerset, Kentucky to, like, that's less the circulation, which I actually think has everything to do with most, you know, in terms of your public access to a Xerox, to a Kinko's, in most of these, they don't have those materials. So until that became readily available, that wasn't even necessarily an option in terms of who would have been circulating those representations. But there's endless work to be done. There's so little done on thinking about LGBT issues in relation to rurality and media. I mean, it's just wide open. So I couldn't encourage you all enough to jump in, because that's that itself would be a great project, and it connects beautifully to Lucinda's too. I did think of the last point that I wanted to make about production, and maybe it goes back to David's point earlier, that for most of these young people, I think they are actively constructing distinctions between offline and online. So in some ways, I'm imposing a bit of that blurring. Like, they're talking about, and I believe, you know, in terms of where we're at in theorizing online, offline, that we're in a place where we're imagining those as separate things, you know, as separate worlds. And we're trying to figure out, Tom Bolstorff has done some more recent stuff, thinking, well, what is it when we impose that kind of spatial structure to imagined communities? You know, what is going on there? And it has some value. So, you know, I'm constantly trying to think, when did they and what become the important moments where they're making these, drawing the distinctions, reproducing a fine line or a distinct line between online and offline? When is it that it's important to them to feel like this is perhaps a boundary public that is entirely online, whether it is or not is beside the point. For the ethnographer, it's what's their understanding of these spaces. So that's the place where I would go back. When I'm trying to fuse them, it's to be able to look at what are the spaces they're moving through and how they're circulating their experiences of visibility that may not be categories that they use themselves, may not be distinctions that they draw, or it may be distinctions that they do for different reasons. So I was thinking about that in terms of production.
We have actually come to our time, but I want to say thank you to everyone here, and thank you, Mary, for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for sticking around. Thanks for sticking around.